Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. All of it brought to you by Quip Electric Toothbrushes. Right now, you can get a Quip toothbrush starting at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/martini right now, you'll get your first refill pack free when it comes to your brushes. So a little bit later, we'll talk more about Quip. But Jim, let's talk about our good martini. And one of the big frustrations we've seen in the past few weeks as the gun debate has heated back up in the wake of the shootings at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, is the fact that the debate, at least in terms of the media, seems to be one-sided a lot. From the Democratic perspective, it seems to be one-sided a lot. And so to get a coherent, passionate, on-point rebuttal from the right is welcome news. We haven't really even gotten that much from Republicans at the federal level. But at the state level, we've got one. This is a viral video from Facebook. This is Virginia Republican delegate Nick Freitas. He is a veteran of the Iraq War, two tours there, was a Green Beret, now a member of the House of Delegates in Virginia. He's also seeking the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate to take on Tim Kaine. And he's running against Corey Stewart for the nomination. So we clearly wish Nick the very best of luck in that endeavor, which we'll probably talk about more as the primary season goes on. But this Facebook post from his speech on the House of Delegates floor went viral over the weekend, 11 million views and counting. First of all, talking here about what the Democrats really think the only solution is.
One of the things that we would look at is arming certain teachers, not every teacher, but a teacher that is comfortable with it, is former law enforcement, is former military, that is now in the classroom. Delegate Plum said yesterday that that was ridiculous to consider. Why? Is it because the other side of this debate will only accept one quote-unquote solution to this problem, and that is tearing apart or gutting the Second Amendment?
And as part of that process, he says there's a very slippery slope when it comes to the left.
If you're wondering the other reason why we can't have an honest debate over this one, is because, quite frankly, I don't think any of us on this side of the aisle believe you when you say that's all you want to do. It'll be bump stocks, it'll be background checks, then it'll be different kind of background checks that register the guns. Then after that, it'll be we need to ban assault weapons. What's an assault weapon? Something that looks scary. Then after that, it'll be semi-automatic rifles. After that, it'll be semi-automatic handguns. Then it'll be revolvers, shotguns. Because when the policies fail to produce the results you are promising to your constituents, you'll be back with more reasons on why we've got to infringe on Second Amendment rights.
Then he talked about who's coming at this debate honestly.
It starts with a certain degree of not assuming that the only reason why we believe in the Second Amendment is because the NRA paid us off. Well, if that's the sort of logic you want to use, why don't you go take a look at how much money the NRA spends and how much money Planned Parenthood spends? Because when I get up here and I talk about abortion, I don't assume that you're all bought and paid for by Planned Parenthood. I don't assume you're horrible people because I disagree with you on a policy position. I assume you have deep convictions and that we can have an argument and a debate about it. But if you're not willing to reciprocate that level of respect, well, don't be surprised when it becomes more difficult to talk about these things.
And he closed with a few thoughts on people who think the government can always protect us.
We are going to have a problem with so-called solutions which infringe on people's liberty under the promise the government will provide for their security. Because ultimately, in this last school shooting, we had a perfect example of government being engaged over 30 times and still failing to provide security for those students.
And we'll talk about another failure down in Broward a little bit later in our podcast. Jim, it's great to have someone who can encapsulate all the arguments, do it coherently, and do it convincingly from a constitutional perspective.
You know, Greg, it is refreshing to hear a conservative who talks about guns and does so in a way that is like firm, but it doesn't come across like Yosemite Sam. It does not come across as over the top and, you know, furious. I'll be honest, there are some folks who I think highly of, who are Second Amendment supporters, who I think are scaring off the suburbanites. My friend Cam Edwards keeps saying we have to be good ambassadors for the Second Amendment. And I think some folks, in their understandable anger about the demagoguery going around this issue, they let their passions get the best of them, and they come across as less than fully hinged, shall we say. This was textbook. This was how you lay it out. You point out the facts on the ground and how a whole lot of these restrictions don't really matter if you don't have law enforcement willing to act in a crisis. We can also kind of fairly ask, what is the point of having the national instant check system if government agencies can't put in the data correctly. These are cases of human error in the Charleston shooting and in the Texas church shooting, in which the person should not have been allowed to purchase the firearm. We're going to talk a little bit more about this later in the podcast, but, you know, this is a case where at least three separate occasions where the Broward police could have either arrested the shooter or could have at least begun the process of that mental health check that would have restricted them from purchasing firearms in the future. You know, there's no point in passing more laws if you're not willing to pass the laws on the books. And this seems like a really strong argument from where I'm sitting in, you know, both in the Virginia and nationwide. I would prefer to see that than just see Corey Stewart trying to make the next the 2018 Senate race all about, you know, statues in Richmond and the glories of the Confederacy. I don't think that's where the Virginia electorate is right now and how you win a race against Tim Kaine, that whirling dervish of raw political charisma.
That's right. That would be enough reason not to vote for Corey Stewart. And Jim, just like with Bob McDonnell, I have to point out, he's raised my taxes. So put those two together, Nick Freitas looks better and better all the time. So, all right, on to the bad martini now. And last night was Oscar night. Blissfully, I missed every second of it. I did hop onto Twitter a little bit, so I saw some of your tweets and others as the evening went on. And you also lead off the Morning Jolt with what seemed like a really good opportunity for Hollywood to look itself in the mirror. And as you said, it then decided to look away. One of the moments at the Oscars was to have three actresses who had basically been blacklisted for not going along with Harvey Weinstein's proclivities, and then they brought them on stage for what could not have been a more vague statement. If you had not been aware of the whole Me Too movement ever since October, you would have no idea what these people are talking about. Here's Annabella Sciorra, Ashley Judd, and Salma Hayek.
This year, many spoke their truth, and the journey ahead is long, but slowly a new path has emerged. The changes we are witnessing are being driven by the powerful sound of new voices, of different voices, of our voices, joining together in a mighty chorus that is finally saying, time's up. So we salute those unstoppable spirits who kicked ass and broke through the biased perceptions against their gender, their race, and ethnicity to tell their stories. And on this 90th anniversary evening, when the Oscars celebrates timeless classics, we also look forward as well.
And we work together to make sure that the next 90 years empower these limitless possibilities of equality, diversity, inclusion, intersectionality. That's what this year has promised us.
So then they launch into this 3 to 4 minute video of supposedly groundbreaking people in every single identity politics group. Jim, you can even hear a couple of sighs in there. I don't know if these ladies were nervous or they were just disgusted that they had to read this script that completely glossed over what they'd been through.
I don't want to give really any grief to those actresses. They've all been through hell, all effectively blacklisted by Weinstein, or at least that's their interpretation of sudden lack of work. The word sexual assault and the word sexual harassment were never in there. And look, we've just figured out that a good chunk of Hollywood was, you know, more or less complicit in this. Everyone kept saying, oh, everyone knew. Weinstein employed a small army of folks who were helping him get away with this, pressuring people, blackmailing people, keeping it out of the press, etc. And look, a blacklist only works if everybody agrees to enforce it. And you know, there's an excellent chance that some of the people that were in the audience there were among those who helped enforce the blacklist that Weinstein had put down on these actresses. Poor Annabella Sciorra, you know, begins it by saying, "It's great to see you. It's been a while," which is the most subtle reference possible. And I'm like, you know, This really isn't a time for subtlety. This was a time I had said only half jokingly I wanted to see Rose McGowan come out and just denounce these people for 10 minutes. I realized the Oscars were never quite going to get into that. You're watching the Oscars and you start tweeting about it. Everyone kind of says, oh, why are you watching? Well, this was the first time in a long time there was actually something of consequence going on at the Oscars. You know, yeah, Trump bashing, you're going to get, you know, that's par for the course. You know, a couple times during every Oscar telecast, you're going to get some Republicans are terrible, conservatives are terrible, et cetera, et cetera. But with this one, there was something much closer to home, a giant elephant in the room that Hollywood needed to address. And it chose to address it in the most vague way possible. There was all this happy talk about how everyone had been empowered, about how things were changing, but no one really wanted to say empowered from what. changing from what? No one really wanted to spend any time on discussing what had gone wrong in the Hollywood system and why so many people, out of a system of fear of watching their careers come to an end, were willing to go along with a deeply corrupt, and I would argue corrupting, philosophy at the entire heart of the Hollywood endeavor. So there's so much more to be said and done last night. Yes, I realize it's supposed to be a celebration of great films, and that's wonderful, but I guess it kind of is a nagging doubt. First of all, at every one of these Oscars, they keep showing you clips from movies you actually watched, as opposed to the current winners. You know, and there's kind of, every time you're looking at the Best Actor and Best Actress nominations, you're usually looking for people who you like from other films that they're not nominated for. This was the Oscars at their worst. Not only the usual flaws going on forever and preachiness and all that kind of stuff, but that at the time when there was, you know, this was the chance. It's the one time you get everybody in Hollywood in one room, which it really could have taken this issue and addressed it head on. And it could have, you know, really, you know, there was a lot of happy talk about the joys of diversity. That's nice. But, you know, that's not what Ronan Farrow and Jody Cantor and the New York Times reporters were doing this big expose about. Was this, oh, there's a lack of diversity in Hollywood. No, it was about systematic sexual abuse. And nobody wanted to really discuss that out in the open. Greg, I don't know about you. I just found it left a really bad taste in my mouth. And that's, you know, I found myself turning towards my Quip toothbrush.
Tell me more.
So when it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of the day. And Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. I've used it this morning. I've used it just about every day. I love it. It's neat. It's fancy. It looks space age. The toothpaste that they bring is really, not only does it taste good, it's really effective. They point out that you don't actually need to use that much of it. Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of bulkier traditional electric brushes. Guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount effortless. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere, whether it's going in your gym bag or carry-on.
And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did. So find out for yourself why. As we mentioned before, Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/martini right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/martini. getquip.com/martini. All right, Jim, we mentioned in the first martini that there's more bad news to come out of Broward County, Florida, and their handling of the Parkland shooting. It seems like it's almost impossible for this story to get worse, but it just keeps getting worse. This is from the Miami Herald. The Broward Sheriff's Office captain, who initially took charge of the chaotic scene at a Parkland high school where 17 people were killed, told deputies to form a perimeter around the deadly scene, which they did, instead of going in to confront the shooter, according to a partial Broward Sheriff's Office dispatch log obtained by the Miami Herald. Captain Jan Jordan, commander of the office's Parkland District, gave the order, the log shows, identifying her by her police call sign. Broward Sheriff Scott Israel has said BSO training and nationwide active shooter procedure call for armed law enforcement officers to confront shooters immediately rather than to secure a scene. The document raises fresh questions about the department's handling of the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14th. So, Jim, Israel keeps being all apoplectic about Scott Peterson and how he should have gone in, which he should have, yet somehow this other captain seems to think this was the appropriate protocol. So either we got people high up that still don't know what they're doing, or Israel's feeding us a line.
You know, Greg, it's really unforgivable at this point. I remember this debate after Columbine in 1999. And you think about it, most police forces, even your SWAT teams, your special weapons and tactics teams, they're used to dealing with a bank robbery or you know, some sort of circumstance in which the purpose of the criminal is to get away. The purpose of the criminal is to get money or something like that, to steal a car, to steal something of value. They're not used to dealing in a situation where someone is trying to kill as many people as possible and has the capacity to do it, and no one around them can stop them. So you could almost forgive the police forces at Columbine for not quite being ready to deal with the ramifications of, oh my goodness, we've got two kids in here who have guns who are trying to kill as many people as possible. But this spurred this national conversation amongst police forces. And there was quite a bit of discussion who said, you know what, we can't sit back and wait, make sure that we've got enough forces and wait for all that kind of stuff. People are being shot at. People are being shot. People are dying. Seconds count. We need to go in there and stop this guy from shooting people as quickly as possible. And most police forces calculate and recognize that. Even if you didn't recognize it after 1999, I would say after 9/11 and after the various jihadist attacks we had seen in the intervening years, San Bernardino, the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting, it all of a sudden became, when you hear respond to a shooting, it is not merely someone who is robbing a bank or someone whose primary motive is to steal something of value. There is a good chance that the person who is shooting intends to kill people. And at that point, every second counts. And if you are an armed police officer, you've taken an oath, you wear that badge, your duty is to try to protect these people. Very few police forces are going to say, oh, the right thing to do is to sit, wait, let him shoot more people while you collect your forces and establish a perimeter or something like that. I would like to see the nation's police forces get on the same page here. The need to confront a potential mass shooter seems pretty clear to me as someone who's, us ordinary citizens who are reliant upon the police to protect ourselves. And of course, as we talked about in our first martini, the argument that citizens don't need firearms to protect themselves seems really weak when we see information like this coming to light.
Unbelievable. But yet it becomes more believable every day in the aftermath of this shooting. Jim, grim start to the week, but we'll do it again tomorrow. Talk to you then.
Yeah, happy Monday, everybody.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to visit our friends at Quip, getquip.com/martini. You get your toothbrush for just $25 and your first refill pack free. Getquip.com/martini. And tune in again Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.